170millionamericans.org to sign up to receive the latest information.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, Sunday, the 13th of March, 2011. Probably the biggest story of the year when we stand back and look at it globally has been the uprisings in the Middle East, largely unforeseen and unanticipated, at least by the conventional wisdom in the West. Not unforeseen by everyone. And our guest today probably is the most savvy American analyst of the Middle East, someone who's been the mentor for countless thousands, if not hundreds of thousands and millions of people in the United States and nationally, internationally. Our guest is Juan Cole from Informed Comment, talking about the Middle East, politics in general. Join us today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
I'm Fraylene Ord.
I'd like to call the Subcommittee on Communications and Technology to order. Today we have a hearing and a markup on network neutrality and HJ Res 37, the resolution of disapproval I introduced to stop the FCC from regulating the Internet.
With his resolution of disapproval, Committee Chairman Greg Walden, a Republican from Oregon, opened the door even wider for more corporate abuse of the Internet. The resolution would strip the Federal Communications Commission of its authority to protect Internet users and give phone and cable companies unrestrained power to block services like online video and audio and restrict free speech. Throughout the hearing, Walden and others spoke of the Internet as if it were never regulated.
We have an open and thriving Internet thanks to our historical hands-off approach. The Internet works pretty well. It's the government that doesn't.
Mike Doyle, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, was clearly frustrated.
You know, up till 2005, the transmission component of DSL service was regulated as a telecommunications service. In the dial-up world, companies provided data transmission. They were obviously regulated as a telecommunications service because the data traveled over phone lines. So, you know, to keep hearing statements that you know, there was never any regulation of the Internet and it worked just peachy keen, it just isn't based in any reality.
Free Press Research Director Derek Turner talked about the lack of competition for Internet service and called for a different kind of reality check.
If we can agree that ensuring access to an open platform is a worthy policy goal, then we have a duty to confront the reality that network owners have strong incentives to close the platform and favor their own content at the expense of everyone else's.
California's Anna Eshoo said she was fascinated by her Republican colleagues' determination to remove authority over the Internet.
Because the stakeholders themselves are on the other side of the issue. The letters that have poured into this committee of groups and organizations across the country, from religious leaders to consumer organizations to high technology associations, they have all weighed in and said, don't do this.
The resolution of disapproval passed the committee along party lines, 15-8. It's expected to pass the House. It will then move to the Senate.
I think there's a virus here in Congress, and it really is not about net neutrality. I think it's about any kind of regulation and whether government agencies have authority to carry out rules through their regulations. I think that's really what's at the heart of this thing.
It's a common complaint across the country. There's not enough real news on the news today. But people disappointed by mainstream media's coverage in their communities have an opportunity to fill that need. Low-powered FM radio. The National Radio Project is one such effort, illuminating social justice issues and giving voice to perspectives often excluded from mainstream news.
It could be environment, it could be war, it could be racism, it could be racial profiling. We're doing a show right now about gang injunctions. It could be media issues and the need for net neutrality.
That's Andrew Stelzer, a producer for the National Radio Project based in Oakland, California. His work has aired nationally and internationally, gaining the attention of programs like NPR's Weekend Edition, Studio 360, and World Radio Switzerland.
We produce our show a couple weeks ahead of time, so it's not usually going to be the news of the day, but maybe stepping back and taking a larger look at the issues and how they relate to different communities and what kind of groups around the country and around the world really are organizing and how they're organizing to try to give the people some influence on important issues of the day.
Before the National Radio Project, Stelzer worked with WMNF in Tampa, where he helped create a successful community radio station that built a robust news department.
And it became influential in influencing the public conversation around issues in Tampa and the Tampa Bay area at large.
Stelzer will be speaking about his experiences at the upcoming National Conference for Media Reform.
There are going to be most likely hundreds, if not thousands, of small, low-powered radio stations opening up around the country, mostly in rural communities away from the big city. What I'm going to be talking about is my belief that these stations should, whatever the word invest means, they should invest in news and producing local news for their community.
Stelzer will join hundreds of other engaging and dynamic activists, journalists, educators, and media reformers at the 2011 National Conference for Media Reform. You can catch him at 9 a.m. on Saturday, April 9th, to hear more about investing in communities through low-power radio. Check out conference.freepress.net for more details.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, this March 13th, 2011. The big news of the year so far, probably, although there's a lot of competition that's coming on, has been the uprisings in the Middle East. And I think when we look at the Middle East as a region, the scholar I look to, the writer I look to first and foremost, is Juan Cole, the professor of history at the University of Michigan, author of numerous books, including Engaging the Muslim World from 2009, and the author of the blog Informed Comment, which can be found at juancole.com, where he covers politics in the Middle East in particular, but politics in general, on a daily basis. Juan Cole, welcome to Media Matters.
It's great to be here, Bob.
And before we get to the extraordinary events of the Middle East that you've been writing about, and you've had contributors who help you write about, too, I should add, add Informed Comment, I do want to talk about something you've written about that I think is getting a little bit of attention here, which is the hearings being conducted by Peter King in the U.S. House of Representatives this past week on the Muslim terrorist, the domestic Muslim terrorist threat in the United States. And I want to preface the question or add to the question or get your feedback on these hearings by something you wrote that I've noticed, too, which is that it seems like more than any group in American society, it's almost legitimate to take cracks, shots at Muslims that no other ethnic group or religious group would ever have to put up with. And I'm reminded of when John McCain was running for president in 2008 and the woman in the question and answer period asked him if Obama were a Muslim, said she thought he was a Muslim. And McCain assured her, no, he's not a Muslim. He's a good family man. As if that sort of settled the matter for evidence. And then more recently, on the other side of the political spectrum, we've seen Bill Maher repeatedly on his HBO television show and in his comedies when talking about Muslims, really talk about them in a manner that is extraordinarily negative, as you could expect out of anyone. So I just, your comments on Peter King and on sort of the treatment and regard for Muslims in our culture.
Well, you know, the principle in American life is that you don't stereotype people across the board with regard to how you treat them legally. I mean, everybody has their prejudices. But when the government starts looking at a community and asking, hey, what's wrong with you guys, then you're generalizing from a few small incidents to a very large community, and it's wrong. And it puts people on the defensive in very unfortunate ways. It encourages workplace discrimination, and all kinds of other unfortunate outcomes. So what King is doing is demagoguery. And it's not just a matter of having a hearing But the premises of the hearing are that there's an increasing radicalization of the American Muslim community, which simply is not true. All of our social science shows that American Muslims are remarkably well integrated into American life. They're more well off than the generality of the public. They're public-minded citizens. Many of them are physicians and, in other ways, pillars of the community, businessmen, entrepreneurs, scientists. So it's just bizarre. There hasn't been any secular trend or upward tick of radicalization. And King says things that are simply false, like that the American Muslim community is not cooperating with law enforcement. In fact, very large numbers of tips that law enforcement has gotten about some crazy guy in the community have come from the community. So, I mean, I think that they're just the wrong premises. And then if you look at the people he called to testify, on the whole and by and large, these are individuals who make their living from fear-mongering about Muslims. There's a whole industry of this kind of thing, populated by people with themselves rather bad credentials with regard to political violence. And King is foremost amongst them. I mean, how hypocritical. You have somebody who was at the forefront of supporting the Irish Republican Army all through the 1980s and 90s, at a time when, you know, the IRA was blowing up Harrod's department store and killed an American doing so in London. And, you know, I sympathize with Irish concerns about Northern Ireland. But for King, who made excuses for terrorism, and, you know, I think nowadays he could be charged as a material supporter of terrorism for his role in the 80s. For him to lead this charge to investigate some other community is bizarre. It's just the height of hypocrisy.
And then, you know, you've written about Bill Maher and his frequent comments about the Islamic world, particularly its contempt for democracy, human rights, and especially the treatment of women. You've responded to that, but I think that what Maher taps is a common belief that Islamic countries across the board lack freedoms, particularly for women, and that women are treated as chattel in these countries, and that they're fairly hopeless, uncivilized places, incapable of, due to their religion, of sort of joining the enlightened world.
Well, Maher, you know, is a comic, and he is also a comic who has made his way in the world by having strong opinions. I agree with 90% of his opinions, and so ordinarily I enjoy watching him. But when he gets on this kick about Muslims, or frankly about religious people in general, he has a strong set of bigoted reactions, which, again, are poorly informed. I mean, he's attacked Buddhists. He's not just Muslims that he's after, but he doesn't understand those societies or that religion and just makes things up. And so, you know, on Friday he said that that the Quran encourages murderous behavior, and murder is forbidden in the Quran. There are passages in the Quran about warfare, but then there are in the Bible as well. So it's just bigotry. It's just prejudice. It's just a way of you know, dumping on 1.5 billion people. And by the way, because of world demographic trends, probably when the world population levels off around 2050, nearly a third of humankind will be Muslim. So Maher is just doomed to be more and more unhappy.
Our guest today, Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan, author of numerous books, including Engaging the Muslim World, published in 2009, and the moderator, writer of Informed Comment, the blog that's available at juancole.com, where he writes almost on a daily basis about developments in politics, particularly in the Middle East, in the Islamic world, but also covering a broad range of issues growing out of that. If you'd like to call in to Media Matters with a question or comment for Professor Cole, the number here is 217-333-9455. That's 333-9455. And we have a toll-free line for those of you out of the area, 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's get right to business if we can, Professor Cole. I think that most people who read the New York Times and Thomas Friedman and other people who write and comment on Middle East politics in the United States would be forgiven, I think, if they thought that what has happened in the last 3 months makes absolutely no sense. We've been told for so long that democracy was a foreign concept to people in the Middle East, unless somehow we invaded and implanted it, I guess. But it's basically not something we could ever expect there, that we had autocratic regimes, and then the only dissent took the form of religious extremists who had contempt for modernity and civil liberties. And what's happened in the last 3 months, as far as I can tell, completely blows that to smithereens, doesn't it?
Well, there's certainly a deep yearning in the Middle East for the people to have more control over their lives, which is part of what we mean by democracy. And apparently, they, having overthrown dictators in Tunisia and Egypt, their plan A is to go to parliamentary elections. So that's certainly something, excuse me, that we think of as democratic. But the thing that I'd like to underline is that very few countries in the world have gotten to parliamentary democracy by themselves. Germany had it imposed on it mm-hmm. after World War II. Spain, Italy, to some extent France, although France was an earlier experimenter with it, by 1944 it was a fascist state. And so the idea that the Middle East is peculiar, or the former Soviet bloc, the Czech Republic, and so forth, the idea that the Middle East is peculiar in this regard is silly, because parliamentary democracy has a history, and it has been taken up as a model by people at various points in time and then given up for a while. So people forget now that in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, there were regular elections for parliament in Egypt, in Lebanon, in Iraq. And they weren't perfect elections, and they tended to be dominated by big landlord elites, but that was true of 18th century England as well. So I think there's a background and a history to belief in parliamentary procedures and rule of law and constitutions. And what's really happened is that in the wake of the end of World War II, the peoples of the Middle East rebelled against their colonial masters. They had been ruled by the British and the French primarily, and they backed regimes that arose, often military regimes, that fought off European control of their lives. The Europeans were making their laws, were setting their taxes, were interfering in their life ways. And they were very proud of the regimes that they erected, which put a premium on national independence and national development, because often the Europeans had not been interested in founding factories and promoting literacy and so forth. So you had these national developments, post-colonial states in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, Gamal Abdel Nasser was this great hero in Egypt of the 50s and 60s. And they stood for independence. They stood for national advancement. And I think people were willing to give them a chance to succeed and didn't make a lot of demands on them with regard to being democratic. And by now, that system deteriorated into a set of corrupt elites, almost mafia states. And the people have said, well, okay, you're not standing for our independence and our development anymore. You're not giving us what you promised us, and moreover, you're oppressing us, and we're just not going to stand for it anymore.
You used the term mafia state. When I was reading, just in preparation for this show, coverage on informed consent of Saudi Arabia, that was exactly the term that came to mind to me, when the description of the huge amount of military aid the United States gives to Saudi Arabia, and I did not realize that Saudi Arabia apparently does not have much of its own military, that the ruling family is so petrified of anyone having arms in that country that they basically cede the military to the United States to a significant extent?
Well, they cede defense of Saudi Arabia's borders, I think, largely to the United States. The Saudis don't get a lot of aid from us, but we sell them a lot of military equipment. And they have very high-tech you know, airplanes, fighter jets and surveillance craft, and they don't have a large infantry because, as you say, the ruling family is a little bit afraid of having a large army where the officer corps might get ambitious. But it's, you know, Saudi Arabia is a very peculiar situation because it's so wealthy that the ruling elite can spread around the wealth to some extent in various ways and kind of buy off people to be quiet about living in an absolute monarchy.
Our guest today, Juan Cole, you're listening to the professor of history at University of Michigan, author of numerous books, including Engaging the Muslim World, published in 2009, and also the moderator and writer of the blog Informed Comment, which can be found at juancole.com. We have phone lines open at 333-9455, our toll-free number open at 1-800-222-9455. We'll be talking about Egypt and Tunisia and Libya throughout the balance of the show, and anything you'd like to talk about as well. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Champaign, line one, you're on the air with Juan Cole. Hello, Champaign. Not hearing Champaign, so I think we'll take a breather on Champaign now. And, you know, one of the things, Professor Cole, that I really enjoy about your blog, Informed Comment, is that even if you read the best of our elite news media journalism coverage of the Middle East, there's either by convention or space or whatever, there's not a lot of background on these nations and how they differ from each other and their politics and their history that really puts a lot of these issues into, makes them sensible, whereas otherwise they're somewhat arbitrary. And I wonder, for the sake of our listeners, if you could take Tunisia and Egypt and start with Tunisia and give a little bit of sense of the background of the country, what provoked the uprising there and where matters stand now?
Sure. Well, I think it is a limitation of journalism as a form that it's very contemporary oriented. The people are interested in what happened 5 minutes ago, and that it's difficult to work into an article in a newspaper very much in the way of historical background or social analysis. But you really do need those tools for understanding. And I'm glad that it creates a space for people like me to do the background. That's what people come to me for. With regard to Tunisia, I mean, it exemplifies those trends that I was talking about. Tunisia had been part of the old Ottoman Empire, ruled from Istanbul, which ruled what we now call the Middle East for many centuries. But in 1881, Tunisia was taken over by France. It had gotten its provincial government had gotten indebted to French bondholders and couldn't repay the debts, and essentially in the 19th century, the great European colonial powers repossessed whole countries. So they repossessed Tunisia in a way, and they incorporated into the French Empire, the same empire that ruled Vietnam and Algeria and much of sub-Saharan Africa. And in the course of World War II, French control of Tunisia was disrupted because the Germans came in, and there were the big tank battles with Patton and Rommel and so forth. And after the end of World War II, France was very weak and had been itself conquered for a while, and the Tunisian independence movement had gotten going. Habib Bourguiba led something called the New Constitutional Party. You see the emphasis on the rule of law and constitution and national independence. And in 1956, won independence from France for Tunisia. So it was one of a whole host of countries that became independent from European colonial empires in Africa and Asia in the 1950s and 60s. And it was, you know, one of these development states. Bourguiba, used government resources to jumpstart industry. It put a big emphasis on educating people. And there were, significant social and economic progress was attained in these ways. But then Bourguiba got old, and by the 1980s he was very old, and frankly, I think, not completely in control of his faculties. And he also had become very oppressive because he was president for life. And so he was edged out. The Italians are said to have helped by a general, Zayd al-Din bin Ali, who took control of the state apparatus. And instead of continuing along the developmentalist model of Bourguiba, bin Ali became a neoliberal. He sold off state concerns and made a lot of economic decisions for the state, and did so increasingly in a nepotistic way. He married a woman named Leila Trabelsi, who had been a hairdresser and was a social climber, and she brought along all of her relatives to the party. And so when Zayd al-Din bin Ali made an economic decision at the highest state level, he would let Leila know about it, and she would let her relatives know about it. And, of course, inside trading like that, it created all kinds of economic opportunities. So the Trabelsis and the bin Alis became enormously wealthy, some of them billionaires. And they were oppressive entrepreneurs. If somebody outside the Golden Circle got a company going and it seemed successful, they would show up and demand to buy it for a song. And they had the backing of the state security police.
Can I ask you one question, Professor Cole? What sort of relationship did the United States government have with this Tunisian government?
Well, the United States was not that close to bin Ali. We didn't give Tunisia a lot of aid. It was kind of in the French sphere of influence, and mm-hmm. we left it there.
Okay.
But we had correct relations, and we did do a little bit of training of their security police for what was called counterterrorism. And, of course, that could be applied to ordinary people. And then we gave them a little bit of money from time to time. But we weren't really, I mean, bin Ali couldn't be blamed on Washington. To some extent, he could be blamed on Rome and France and Paris, I suppose. But he certainly was very cooperative in what was called the War on Terror, and he got points with Washington for that. Bin Ali represented himself as a secular bulwark against hordes of Muslim terrorists and fundamentalists sweeping into Europe from the Tunisian deserts. And at the same time that his family were just looting this place. And so, the developmentalist policies, some of them remained in place, like they'd sent a lot of people to college. So you ended up with, you know, very large numbers of college graduates who, however, had no prospects and no jobs. And there were something like 600,000 Tunisians out of 10 million who went to Europe for jobs, mainly France. And so by, you know, a couple years ago, people were becoming really frustrated at the way the bin Ali mafia regime was getting in the way of their lives. And so many people were unemployed among the educated. And as a historian, I want to tell you, as a ruler, you never want large numbers of disgruntled, educated people in your country. So they know how to network, and they did so. And then the working class movement, you know, there's a long tradition going back to the French days of trade union activism. That had gotten going, and, you know, the combination of union organizing and white-collar discontent, when those two forces join hands, that's a very powerful combination. And then they joined hands with a third group, which was disgruntled college students and youth. So, you know, white-collar, middle-class office workers and other white-collar occupations, union workers and college students, if the three of them get together, that's an explosion, and that's what happened in Tunisia. And it reminds me a little bit of the late 60s in the United States.
Well, it actually sounds a little bit like what's been happening in Madison, Wisconsin for the last 3 weeks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our guest today, Juan Cole, the head of the lead blogger at Informed Comment, which is at juancole.com, professor of history at the University of Michigan. Phone lines open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We're talking Middle East politics, questions and comments. Welcome. Let's go to the phone lines now, our toll-free line. Line 4, Lafayette, Indiana. You're on the air with Professor Cole.
Hello. There are two things I hope you can put together in some kind of way. One is the Arab League voting for the no-fly zone, which presumably from all of the radio stations I've been listening to surprised the hell out of everybody. And two, the sort of I don't know. I mean, I'm a Democrat and all that, but it just bothers me that we didn't get in there first now to cover the error. I was wondering if you could give some perspective on that, bring those two things together if possible, and what you think the outcome could be, you know, in various strategies that it might obtain with the fly zone. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. And if I can just interject, Professor Cole, if you could maybe give a little background on Libya to put the no-fly zone debate in context and Libyan-American relations.
Sure. Well, Libya had been an Italian colony up until World War II, and after that it was lost to the Italians. In 1969, you had a coup against the then king by a young colonel, Muammar Gaddafi, who was from a Bedouin tribal background. And Gaddafi ruled Libya not only as a military man and cultivating an officer corps that was loyal to him, but also reached out to Libya's tribes. Being an arid country, Libya had a lot of tribes who, you know, raised sheep and goats, and kinship politics was very important. Libya is very different in this regard from urban places like Tunisia and to some extent Egypt. So you know, Libya was another one of those post-colonial states that prided itself in standing for Arab and African independence from the West, and was involved in various kinds of terrorism against the West. And, of course, famously, Ronald Reagan tried to kill Gaddafi in an airstrike because he was seen as an annoyance. This revolt that broke out against Gaddafi put everybody on a spot, because in the course of the 90s, Libya had been under European Union and U.S. economic sanctions, and they had told. They had made a mark, and Gaddafi changed his ways. He ceased supporting terrorism, and he gave up, you know, his plans, very vague plans as they were, for nuclear plants and chemical and biological weapons. So was kind of welcomed back into the fold of the international community under the Bush administration, and that is a process that had happened earlier in Britain and France and the European Union. So he's made a lot of oil deals, and Libya's economy has opened back up in the absence of sanctions. And so when this popular revolt broke out against him, it raised questions. Well, were the new guys going to honor the old oil contracts? Who were they? Were they Muslim fundamentalists? Were they going to upset the order in the Eastern Mediterranean? Who did they support? They were unknown. And I think a lot of the West thought that, you know, better the devil you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's been real foot dragging about intervening in Libya, and I think a kind of silent hope that Gaddafi just reasserts himself, except in select countries. David Cameron in Britain has been hoping to overthrow Gaddafi, in part because Gaddafi had ordered the destruction of the airliner over Lockerbie, Scotland, and the British have a grudge with him. But the Arab League has come out for the people, and of course Egypt and Tunisia have an interest in doing so, since their current regimes are the result of popular uprisings.
Mm-hmm. And they sandwich Libya.
And they yes, that's right.
At least along the Mediterranean.
That's right. That's right. You know, for Gaddafi to reassert himself is a real problem for the new regimes in Tunisia and Egypt. And then over the years, Gaddafi, you know, is a little bit erratic and very annoying, and he's angered most of the Arab heads of state. I mean, he's viciously attacked the Saudis, and so it's actually not so surprising that most of the Arab League wants him gone.
And so where does the no-fly zone come into play here?
Well, some elements of Gaddafi's military have remained loyal to him. That's the difference between Tunisia and Egypt on the one hand and Libya on the other. In Egypt and Tunisia, the military, you know, pretty unitedly told the presidents for life that they weren't going to fire on their citizens for them. And so Mubarak and Ben Ali were forced out because the military wouldn't use force against the civilian population for them. But in Libya, elements of the military are perfectly willing to use force against civilians and force against the rebels, and especially elements of the Air Force. So Gaddafi is able to fly fighter jets and bombers against rebel positions. He's also able to terrorize civilian populations by simply bombing them. It's an advantage for him, and it could well be an advantage that's decisive in his retaking of the country, because as we speak, his forces are marching east towards the rebel strongholds, and one after another they're falling. So many have thought that, well, if you could deny him the advantages of his air power, if you could simply make a rule that he can't fly airplanes, and if he tries to, they'll be shot down, that would, in effect, level the playing ground and give the rebels a fighting chance.
I sense you don't share the hesitance towards opposing Gaddafi that perhaps some leaders in the Western world do.
Well, I don't believe that the people in Benghazi who have risen up against him are al-Qaeda. I don't think that they're notably, radical fundamentalists or anything. They're just the people of Benghazi. And so I'm not afraid of what would come after Gaddafi in the way that I think the Obama administration is genuinely very concerned about who these people are and what they would undertake if they came to power. It seems to me that Gaddafi has behaved in a way that's just unacceptable. I mean, not only is there the whole background of his terrorism and blowing up civilian airliners and so forth, but since the rebellion began, he's committed massacres. It's very clear that he massacred people in downtown Zawiya, that bulldozed people into mass graves, and bombed civilians. And it just seems to me that if he's allowed to reassert himself, it's a black mark against the international community.
Has Gaddafi been the same caliber of kleptocrat as Mubarak and Ben Ali?
Well, Gaddafi didn't have that reputation earlier on. He actually, among the oil states, Libya was more conscientious in sharing out the oil wealth with ordinary people. So Gaddafi would do things like buy tractors for the farmers. And it's Gini coefficient, the way you measure wealth stratification, was much, much less than the conservative Gulf oil states. So it had a reputation of being a bit more progressive in that regard. But in the past 15 years or so, it appears to be the case, and of course Libya is a place that's very murky to find out what's going on there, but it appears to be the case that Gaddafi increasingly directed the oil goodies as he was under sanction and there were less of them towards his strongest tribal supporters in the West. And the people of the East in Benghazi and Tobruk and so forth felt really disadvantaged and left out of the nation's wealth. And so you can see that in the way that the country really, as we speak, is in two parts. There's a fairly significant pro-Gaddafi population in the West, and then the entire East is in rebellion.
Before we go back to the phone lines for Professor Cole, our guest today in Media Matters, I have one question I want to ask you, which is, the role WikiLeaks has played in the Middle East uprisings. I hear varying accounts. Sometimes I see WikiLeaks almost never mentioned. Other times they're the lead, that the revelations from the WikiLeaks cables were sort of like throwing a match onto the prairie. What's your take?
Well, I personally don't think the WikiLeaks have been very important in all this, but they have played a role. I wouldn't discount them altogether. For instance, just to give you an example, in Tunisia, it was often said that Ben Ali was surrounded by social climbers and corrupt people from his family and the family of his wife, Leila Trabelsi, but that he himself was not known to be personally corrupt. And so, you know, if you could just get through to the president and let him know what his relatives were doing, maybe you could get some reforms. And in late fall of last year, WikiLeaks cables were revealed, which detailed Ben Ali's own corruption, instances where he seemed to want to intervene in the founding of a private university, for instance, to take a cut for himself of profits. And so, you know, the last shreds of regime legitimacy were ripped away by this revelation, especially since it came from the U.S. Embassy and so had some credibility. So I don't think that you could discount them altogether, but, you know, by that time, the revolts in the streets were already going on, and it wasn't as if the Ben Ali regime were liked beforehand and so forth. But it did, at the margins, perhaps play a role.
Our guest, Juan Cole, the author of Engaging the Muslim World from 2009, also a professor of history at the University of Michigan, and he was the author of the blog Informed Comment, which can be found at juancole.com, where you will find almost on a daily basis or frequent updates and analyses of Middle East politics and politics in general. The number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line one, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Yeah, I have a broader question about the U.S. role, on the Libyan affair, it seems to me, I don't know who Hillary Clinton is talking to, as whether they're really representative of the, you know, opposition, the rebel forces or not, but as far as the people in Libya who might want an intervention, it seems that one should consider the fact that it might be Gaddafi that would want it, because it would transform the fight, and it would perhaps rally some people in Libya against the outside attackers, so that it might be entirely counterproductive. And I haven't heard that argument really explored. On the broader idea of what the U.S. role is, I mean, the U.S. has lots of black marks already, and they're not often acknowledged. But it seems to me that I wanted you to respond to this line of discourse that sort of neoliberals like Krautheimer, et cetera, make, that this is actually the fruit of the Bush 2 democratic agenda, like there really was one in anything that he was doing. I guess that's enough to chew on. I don't know.
I think that's a great question, and thank you very much. So if I can just add in there for listeners who might not follow the Bush agenda, Professor Cole, the idea, I guess, would be that our invasion of Iraq specifically, and to a lesser extent Afghanistan, which created democracies in formerly undemocratic turf, has sort of planted seeds for revolutions elsewhere. What do you make of that?
Well, the argument is propagandistic, as were almost all arguments coming out of the Bush administration. The fact is that nobody on the ground in Egypt or Tunisia or Yemen ever said, oh, goody, let's try to be more like Iraq. There was no shining beacon on a hill here.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, people, I saw Twitter feeds that actively cautioned people against an Iraqi outcome. One of the...
What does an Iraqi outcome mean?
Well,
what is that?
Civil war.
Oh, okay.
what Iraq meant to most people in the Arab world was, you know, foreign military occupation, encouraging or allowing people to murder each other on a large scale because of identity politics. That's how they saw the whole Iraq venture. And so they would caution each other, let's not allow an Iraq. I mean, I think there was concern that there not be an opening to foreign intervention, that people not allow themselves to be divided, say, in Egypt among Coptic Christians and Muslims. So Iraq was only instanced as a negative example by the protesters everywhere I've seen, and very seldom mentioned, actually. So there's no evidence that people are emulating the Bush experiment. And in fact, there's every evidence that they are trying to avoid any such thing. The other thing to note is that the Iraqi government itself has faced massive protests
similar to those in some other countries, which doesn't suggest that experiment has succeeded very well. I mean, if people are still in the streets demonstrating, it doesn't mean that they haven't gotten what they think of as democracy. Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister of Iraq, was constrained to actually cut off Baghdad via closing bridges to prevent people from streaming into downtown Baghdad and replicating the scenes in downtown Cairo, and has faced big demonstrations in the Sunni Arab areas, in the Shiite south, and there have been big demonstrations by Kurds against the Kurdistan Alliance, the Kurdish parties who had been allied with Bush, who in a rather authoritarian way dominate the north of Iraq. So, the Iraqis don't seem to think that they've gotten democracy, and they're protesting actively against their own regime. And B, nobody is instancing this experiment as an inspiration.
Juan Cole, I think the country that's been the most striking, at least to me from where I'm sitting, has been Egypt and what has happened there, if only because Egypt's by far the most populous country in the Arab world. And I was wondering, for those of us who just, you know, scan, listen to CNN or see occasional news stories in a newspaper, what do you think the jumps out at you about the Egyptian revolution that's most interesting, most salient, most important that Americans should try to understand?
Sure. Well, and you're absolutely right that Egypt is central. You know, Cairo is kind of like a combination of the Washington, D.C. of the Arab world and the place where most important politics takes place, and the Hollywood of the Arab world, because the films and dramas are often made there. So it's enormously influential. The Egyptian population is 81 million. There are about 300 million Arabs, so it's very nearly a fourth of the Arab world. And what happens in Cairo matters for the whole region. And especially now that you have satellite networks which carry news and interviews and so forth all over the region, the influential character of Cairo could increase now that it is opening up. I think the successes of the Tunisian revolution are so far more significant and long-lasting than in Egypt. In both cases, more or less, the protesters forced out the strongman and provoked a kind of military coup, which, however, involved the setting up of a provisional civilian government to transition. In Tunisia, they've abolished the Ministry of Information, so there's no censorship in Tunisia as we speak. And now they have abolished also the whole arm of the secret police. Similar demands are being made in Egypt. In Tunisia also, they got rid of the emergency laws, which limited civil liberties. In Egypt, they've gotten a lot of promises from the military regime and from its civilian face, which is the cabinet that's currently in place of Essam Sharaf. They've gotten the prime minister that they want. They've had real successes in changing the face of the regime, and they've gotten promises that the Egypt will go to parliamentary elections in September and presidential elections. So things are, potentially have opened up, but the emergency laws are still in place. There's still government censorship. The army cleared the last of the demonstrators from Tahrir Square, insisting that, people settle down now until the elections. So the process has not gone as deep or as surely in the direction of a real opening in Egypt as yet, as you have seen in Tunisia. But if the Tunisian reforms could be replicated in Egypt, then it would be a whole new world, an Arab world's Arab countries, whole regimes that had no state censorship and no secret police. This would be an epical change in the region.
Our guest Juan Cole. Let's go to our final caller now. Line 4, Spring Bay. You're on the air with Professor Cole.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I'm wondering if you could give any set of predictions or ideas of where Iraq may be headed in the next 2 to 4 years, if we are able to extricate ourselves from that, what do you think we might be leaving behind, and what might be the future of Iraqi oil production to the West? And I'll get off and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Professor Cole?
Well, personally, I think it's likely that Iraq will just limp along for a long time. I think the U.S. really will get out almost all of its military forces by the end of this year. I think the government in place of Nouri al-Maliki and the new Iraqi army are just all right. They'll be, you know, they won't be overthrown anytime soon, and they can probably keep minimal order. But you know, there's a lot of protest movements in the country. There are still terrorist cells that regularly blow up big things, including government buildings. There's still a staccato, low-level, unconventional war going on, which is killing several hundred people a month. And we saw in Lebanon from 1975 to 1991 during the Lebanese Civil War the way that sectarian and political fracturing of a country can lead to a very long civil war. And so I think, you know, in social science terms, Iraq is still in civil war, and my guess is that it will limp along like that for some time until finally the various communities, the Sunni Arabs, the Shiites, and the Kurds, that their leadership can make a grand bargain. There's not good evidence that this unconventional guerrilla war and the terrorism strikes and so forth are necessarily disruptive of the Iraqi petroleum industry as it now exists. It probably most of the people who are engaging in violence would like themselves to take over those facilities, and so they're not damaging them. But it is a problem if you don't have security of getting a lot of new investment, developing new fields, and so forth. So I would say that the political uncertainties are blunting Iraq's potential for development. So it's now doing, I think, 2.8 million barrels a day and exporting probably a couple million of those. It can probably go on doing that. From time to time, the terrorist strikes do close down refineries, as we've had 2 weeks ago at Beji, and some pipelines get hit from time to time, but they seem to be able to repair that damage and get them back online after a few months. But if you're an oil company and you have the opportunity to put several billion dollars into Iraq in developing new fields or new refineries, under these circumstances, is that really how you want to use your money? And so I think Iraq's potential is going to be blunted for a while. But I do expect the country eventually to settle down and for people to make the grand bargains that would allow a return to normalcy and even prosperity. I wouldn't be surprised if 20 years out, Iraq began to be a very nice place to be and, in fact, kind of expensive to be. But I think it'll take a while.
Juan Cole, it was about a week and a half ago that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and she was bemoaning the ineffectiveness of U.S. international broadcasting and international media. And she specifically cited the Middle East as an area in which the U.S. message, either through our commercial international news or through the Voice of America and through our government international media, simply wasn't measuring up to what competitors are doing. And we were losing out as a result, and this was a real problem for the United States. And I was wondering if you thought she was accurate. And secondly, along these lines, what role does Al Jazeera now play in Middle East politics?
Al Jazeera plays an extremely important role in Middle Eastern politics because it has a philosophy of reporting all sides of an issue. And so doesn't go along with various censorship regimes. It's one of the reasons that it's controversial in the United States, because they will interview al-Qaeda types or they'll interview Hamas, but they'll also interview, you know, Israeli officials and American ones. And their model of journalism is you tell all sides of a conflict. I never had thought about it in this way, but the American model of journalism is a kind of very strict 1940s liberal model where you don't allow what you see as the fringe a voice. And so in a conflict, you would never interview your country's enemy. So that it's actually, I think, in some ways, the Al Jazeera model is better suited to our new information age, where information is widely available. So the fact that it reports on all sides and gives voice to various factions has helped to open up Arab politics. It is true that the United States official media are useless. The Bush administration reaction to 9/11 was to abolish the Arabic service of the Voice of America, if you can believe that.
Mm-hmm.
The Voice of America has no Arabic service. It used to be that we would broadcast it to the Arab world, admittedly on shortwave, but people would listen to the programs, and they were often quite good. That was just gotten rid of. And it was replaced by something called Radio Sawa, which was based on the top 40 AM format, with a little bit of 5-minute news broadcasts, which were very propagandistic. And then the U.S. Also founded this Al Hurra satellite TV network, which nobody watches, and it's extremely dull. So, what the U.S. government has done in the way of getting out the word to the Arab world about itself has been worse than useless. It's been counterproductive. And I think there's no congressional oversight over it because it's all done by bureaucrats who know people who know Arabic. And the congressmen don't even realize, I think, probably, that the Voice of America Arabic service is gone. And then there's no effort at publications to speak of. There's a small translation program. We've done some novels. The State Department translated Toni Morrison and so forth. But I did a literature search and found that Thomas Jefferson had never been translated into Arabic. So I founded a foundation, and I've got a Beirut publisher on the verge of bringing out a collected works of Thomas Jefferson in Arabic for the first time next month. And the U.S. government ought to have been doing things like that, but it doesn't. So now they're cutting back the National Endowment for the Humanities, and it seems likely there will be even less of that. And however the Arabic book and television market works, it doesn't pick up the positive programming or the positive books about the United States, and the market doesn't do that work. So nobody's translating, the good programs on the Discovery Channel into Arabic very much. Our public diplomacy, our media outreach are horrible. The Arab world loves, Hollywood, and they'll go see the latest action film all you like. But if you were trying to convey something serious about how American democracy works, there's nothing that does that in that world.
Professor Cole, we've just got a few seconds left, and I just wanted to ask you finally, from your looking at what's going on in Israel now, what is the range of Israeli opinion about the revolutions going on in the Arab world?
Well, the status quo had favored Israel, so the Israeli public is as nervous as a long-tailed cat in a room full of rocking chairs. they're really concerned about where all this is going and how it's going to affect them. They're worried about the peace treaties with Jordan and Egypt, which have been so important to their security. And I think it's certainly the case that a more populist parliamentary regime in Egypt will not cooperate with the blockade of the people of Gaza that the Israelis have imposed. So some Israeli policy is probably doomed. The Israelis have the strongest military in the region. In some ways, they had the strongest hand in the region because the Mubarak regime had been bribed to just stay quiet and not bother. This populist fervor abroad in the region does suggest that popular causes like those of the Palestinians might get more support, more practical support, not just verbal support.
On that note, so, Professor Cole, unfortunately I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of here. I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Media Matters, and hope to have you back on the show again in the future.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Great. And I want to thank Kyle Kroha, my engineer, the producer, Melissa Trentz, for their great work. I'm Bob McChesney. Everyone have a great week. We'll see you in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.